This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Riptide by Douglas Preston and Lincoln Chime. Read by Scott Brick. Such a day. Rum all out. Our company somewhat sober. A damned confusion amongst us. Rogues a-plotting. Great talk of separation. So I looked sharp for a prize. Such a day took one, with a great deal of liquor on board. So kept the company hot, damned hot. Then all things went well again. From the logbook of Edward Teach, a.k.a. Blackbeard, circa 1718. Applying 20th century solutions to 17th century problems affords either absolute success or absolute chaos. There is no middle ground. Orville Horn, Ph.D. Prologue. On an afternoon in June 1790, a Maine cod fisherman named Simon Rutter became caught in a storm and a strong riptide. His dory overloaded with fish, he went badly off course and was forced to put in at fog-bound Ragged Island, 6 miles off the coast. While waiting for the heavy weather to pass, the fisherman decided to explore the deserted spot. Inland from the rocky bluffs that gave the islet its name, he found a massive old oak tree with an ancient block and tackle dangling from one low-slung limb. Directly underneath it, the ground had subsided into a depression. Although the island was known to be uninhabited, Rudder found clear evidence that someone had visited many years before. His curiosity aroused, Rudder enlisted the aid of a brother and returned one Sunday several weeks later with picks and shovels. Locating the depression in the ground, the men began to dig. After 5 feet, they hit a platform of oak logs. They pulled up the logs and, with increasing excitement, kept digging. By the end of the day, they had dug almost 20 feet, passing through layers of charcoal and clay to another oak platform. The brothers went home, intending to renew their digging after the annual mackerel run. But a week later, Rudder's brother was drowned when his dory capsized in a freak accident. The pit was temporarily abandoned. 2 years later, Rudder and a group of local merchants decided to pool their resources and return to the mysterious spot on Ragged Island. Resuming the dig, they soon reached a number of heavy vertical oak beams and cross-joists, which appeared to be the ancient cribbing of a backfilled shaft. Precisely how deep the group dug has been lost to history. Most estimates assume close to 100 feet. At this point, they struck a flat rock with an inscription carved into it. "First will ye lie, cursed shall ye cry, worst must ye die." The rock was dislodged and hoisted to the surface. It has been theorized that the removal of the rock broke a seal, because moments later, without warning, a flood of seawater burst into the pit. All the diggers escaped, except Simon Rudder. The water pit, as the flooded shaft became known, had claimed its first victim. Many legends grew up about the water pit, but the most plausible held that around 1695, the notorious English pirate Edward Ockham buried his vast hoard somewhere along the Maine coast shortly before his mysterious death. The shaft at Ragged Island seemed a likely candidate. Shortly after Rudder's death, rumors began to circulate that the treasure was cursed, and that anyone attempting to plunder it would suffer the fate threatened on the stone. Numerous unsuccessful efforts were made to drain the water pit. In 1800, two of Rudder's former partners formed a new company and raised money to finance the digging of a second tunnel, 12 feet to the south of the original pit. All went well for the first 100 feet of digging, at which point they attempted to dig a horizontal passage beneath the original water pit. Their scheme was to tunnel up from underneath the treasure, but as soon as they angled in toward the original pit, the passage rapidly began filling with water. The men barely escaped with their lives. For 30 years the pit lay fallow. Then, in 1831, the Bath Expeditionary Salvage Company was formed by a downstate mining engineer named Richard Parkhurst. A friend of one of the original merchants, Parkhurst was able to gain valuable information about the earlier workings. Parkhurst decked over the mouth of the water pit and set up a large steam-driven pump. He found it impossible to drain the seawater. Undaunted, he brought in a primitive coal-drilling rig, which he positioned directly over the pit. The drill went well beyond the original depth of the pit, striking planking as deep as 170 feet, until the drill was stopped by something impenetrable. When the drilling pipe was removed, bits of iron and scales of rust were found jammed in the torn bit. The pod also brought up putty, cement, and large quantities of fiber. This fiber was analyzed and found to be manila grass, or coconut fiber. This plant, which grows only in the tropics, was commonly used as dunnage in ships to keep cargo from shifting. Shortly after this discovery, the Bath Expeditionary Salvage Company went bankrupt, and Parkhurst was forced to leave the island. In 1840, the Boston Salvage Company was formed and began digging a third shaft in the vicinity of the water pit. After only 66 feet, they unexpectedly struck an ancient side tunnel that appeared to lead from the original pit. Their own shaft filled instantly with water, then collapsed. Undaunted, the entrepreneurs dug yet another very large shaft 30 yards away, which became known as the Boston Shaft. Unlike earlier tunnels, the Boston Shaft was not a vertical pit, but was instead cut on a slope. Striking a spur of bedrock at 70 feet, they angled downward for another 50 feet at enormous expense, using augers and gunpowder. Then they drove a horizontal passage beneath the presumed bottom of the original water pit, where they found cribbing and the continuation of the original backfilled shaft. Excited, they dug downward, clearing the old shaft. At 130 feet, they struck another platform, which they left in place while debating whether to pull it up. But that night, the camp was awakened by a loud rumble. The diggers rushed out to find that the bottom of the water pit had fallen into the new tunnel with such force that mud and water had been ejected 30 feet beyond the mouth of the Boston Shaft. Among this mud, a crude metal bolt was discovered, similar to what might be found on a banded sea chest. Over the next 20 years, a dozen more shafts were dug in an attempt to reach the treasure chamber, all of which flooded or collapsed. 4 more treasure companies went bankrupt. In several cases, diggers emerged swearing that the flooding was no accident, and that the original builders of the water pit had designed a diabolical mechanism to flood any side shafts that might be dug. The Civil War brought a brief respite to the diggings. Then, in 1869, a new treasure-hunting company secured the rights to dig on the island. The dig foreman, F. X. Wrench, noticed that water rose and fell in the pit in accordance with the tides, and theorized that the pit and its water traps must all be connected to the sea by an artificial flood tunnel. If the tunnel could be found and sealed, the pit could be drained and the treasure removed safely. In all, Wrench dug more than 12 exploratory shafts of varying depths in the vicinity of the water pit. Many of these shafts encountered horizontal tunnels and rock pipes, which were dynamited in an attempt to stop the water. However, no flood tunnel to the sea was ever found, and the water pit remained flooded. The company ran out of money and, like those before, left its machinery behind to rust quietly in the salt air. In the early 1880s, Gold Seekers Limited was formed by a consortium of industrialists from Canada and England. Powerful pumps and a new kind of drill were floated out to the island, along with boilers to power them. The company tried boring several holes into the water pit, finally hitting pay dirt on August 23, 1883. The drill came up against the plate of iron that had defeated Parkhurst's drill 50 years before. A new diamond bit was fitted, and the boilers were stoked to a full head of steam. This time, the drill bored through the iron and into a solid block of a softer metal. When the corer was extracted, a long, heavy curl of pure gold was found inside its grooves, along with a rotten piece of parchment and two broken phrases. Silks, canary wine, ivory, and John Hyde rotting on the Deptford gibbet. Half an hour after the discovery was made, one of the massive boilers exploded, killing an Irish stoker and leveling many of the company's structures. 13 were injured, and one of the principals, Ezekiel Harris, was left blinded. Gold Seekers Limited followed its predecessors into bankruptcy. The years immediately before and after 1900 saw three more companies try their luck at the water pit. Unsuccessful in duplicating the discovery of Gold Seekers Limited, these companies used newly designed pumps in concert with randomly placed underwater charges in an attempt to seal and drain the waterlogged island. Working at their utmost capacity, the pumps were able to lower the water level in several of the central shafts by about 20 feet at low tide. Excavators sent down to examine the condition of the pits complained of noxious gases. Several fainted and had to be hauled to the surface. While the last of the three companies was at work in early September 1907, a man lost one arm and both legs when an explosive charge went off prematurely. 2 days later, a vicious nor'easter howled up the coast and wrecked the primary pump. Work was abandoned. Although no more companies came forward, individual diggers and enthusiasts still occasionally dared to try their hands at exploratory tunnels. By this time, the original location of the water pit had been lost among the countless flooded side shafts, holes, and tunnels that riddled the heart of the island. At last the island was abandoned to the ospreys and the chokecherry bushes, its very surface unstable and dangerous, shunned by the mainland townspeople. It was in 1940 that Alfred Westgate Hatch Sr., a young, wealthy New York financier, brought his family to Maine for the summer. He learned of the island and, growing intrigued, researched its history. Documentation was spotty. None of the previous companies had bothered to keep careful records. 6 years later, Hatch purchased the island from a land speculator and moved his family to Stormhaven. As had so many others before him, A.W. Hatch Sr. became obsessed with the water pit and was ruined by it. Within 2 years, the family's finances had been drained and Hatch was forced to declare personal bankruptcy. He turned to drink and died soon after, leaving A.W. Hatch Jr., at 19, the sole support for his family. Chapter 1. July, 1971. Malin Hatch was bored with summer. He and Johnny had spent the early part of the morning throwing rocks at the hornet's nest in the old well house. That had been fun. But now there was nothing else to do. It was just past 11, but he'd already eaten the 2 peanut butter and banana sandwiches his mother had made him for lunch. Now he sat cross-legged on the floating dock in front of their house, looking out to sea, hoping to spot a battleship steaming over the horizon. Even a big oil tanker would do. Maybe it would head for one of the outer islands, run aground, and blow up. Now that would be something. His brother came out of the house and rattled down the wooden ramp leading to the dock. He was holding a piece of ice on his neck. "Got you good," Malin said, secretly satisfied that he had escaped stinging, and that his older, supposedly wiser brother had not. "You just didn't get close enough," Johnny said through his last mouthful of sandwich. "Chicken." "I got as close as you." "Yeah, sure. All those bees could see was your skinny butt running away." He snorted and winged the piece of ice into the water. "No, sir, I was right there." Johnny plopped down beside him on the dock, dropping his satchel next to him. "We fixed those bees pretty good, though, huh, Mel?" he said, testing the fiery patch on his neck with one forefinger. "Sure did." They fell silent. Mullen looked out across the little cove toward the islands in the bay. Hermit Island, Wreck Island, Old Hump, Killick Stone. And far beyond, the blue outline of Ragged Island, appearing and disappearing in the stubborn mist that refused to lift even on this beautiful midsummer day. Beyond the islands, the open ocean was, as his father often said, as calm as a mill pond. Languidly, he tossed a rock into the water and watched the spreading ripples without interest. He almost regretted not going into town with his parents. At least it would be something to do. He wished he could be anywhere else in the world. Boston, New York. Anywhere but Maine. "Ever been to New York, Johnny?" he asked. Johnny nodded solemnly. "Once. Before you were born." What a lie, Mullen thought. As if Johnny would remember anything that had happened when he was less than 2 years old. But saying so out loud would be to risk a swift punch in the arm. Mullen's eye fell on the small outboard tied at the end of the dock, and he suddenly had an idea. A really good idea. "Let's take it out," he said, lowering his voice and nodding at the skiff. "You're crazy," Johnny said. "Dad would whip us good." "Come on," Mullen said. "They're having lunch at the Hastings after they finish shopping. They won't be back until 3, maybe 4. Who's going to know?" "Just the whole town, that's all, seeing us going out there." "Nobody's going to be watching," said Mullen. Then, recklessly, he added, "Who's chicken now?" But Johnny did not seem to notice this liberty. His eyes were on the boat. "So where do you want to go that's so great anyway?" he asked. Despite their solitude, Mullen lowered his voice further. "Ragged Island?" Johnny turned toward him. "Dad'll kill us," he whispered. "He won't kill us if we find the treasure." "There's no treasure," Johnny said scornfully, but without much conviction. "Anyway, it's dangerous out there with all those pits." Mullen knew enough about his brother to recognize the tone in his voice. Johnny was interested. Mullen kept quiet, letting the monotonous morning solitude do his persuading for him. Abruptly, Johnny stood up and strode to the end of the dock. Mullen waited, an anticipatory thrill coursing through him. When his brother returned, he was holding a life preserver in each hand. "When we land, we don't go farther than the rocks along the shore." Johnny's voice was deliberately gruff, as if to remind Mullen that simply having one good idea didn't alter their balance of power. "Understood?" Mullen nodded, holding the gunwale while Johnny tossed in his satchel and the life preservers. He wondered why they hadn't thought of doing this before. Neither boy had ever been to Ragged Island. Mullen didn't know any kids in the town of Stormhaven who ever had either. It would make a great story to tell their friends. "You sit in the bow," Johnny said, "and I'll drive." Mullen watched Johnny fiddle with the shift lever, open the choke, pump the gas bulb, then yank the starter cord. The engine coughed, then fell silent. Johnny yanked again, then again. Ragged Island was 6 miles offshore, but Mullen figured they could make it in a half hour on such a smooth sea. It was close to high tide when the strong currents that swept the island dropped down to nothing before reversing. Johnny rested, his face red, and then turned again for a heroic yank. The engine sputtered into life. "Cast off!" he shouted. As soon as the rope was uncleated, Johnny shoved the throttle all the way forward, and the tinny little 18-horsepower engine whined with exertion. The boat surged from the dock and headed out past Breed's Point into the bay, wind and spray stinging Mullen's face delightfully. The boat sent back a creamy wake as it sliced through the ocean. There had been a massive storm the week before, but as usual it seemed to have settled the surface, and the water was glassy. Now Old Hump appeared to starboard, a lone naked dome of granite, streaked with seagull lime and fringed with dark seaweed. As they buzzed through the channel, countless seagulls, drowsing one-legged on the rock, raised their heads and stared at the boat with bright yellow eyes. A single pair rose into the sky, then wheeled past, crying a lost cry. "This was a great idea," Mullen said. "Wasn't it, Johnny?" "Maybe," Johnny said. But if we get caught, it was your idea. Even though their father owned Ragged Island, they had been forbidden to visit it for as long as he could remember. Their dad hated the place and never talked about it. Schoolyard legend held that countless people had been killed there digging for treasure, that the place was cursed, that it harbored ghosts. There were so many pits and shafts dug over the years that the island's innards were completely rotten, ready to swallow the unwary visitor. He'd even heard about the curse stone. It had been found in the pit many years before, and now it was supposedly kept in a special room deep in the church basement, locked up tight because it was the work of the devil. Johnny once told him that when kids were really bad in Sunday school, they were shut up in the crypt with the cursed stone. He felt another shiver of excitement. The island lay dead ahead now, wreathed in clinging tatters of mist. In winter, or on rainy days, the mist turned to a suffocating pea-soup fog. On this bright summer day, it was more like translucent cotton candy. Johnny had tried to explain the local rip currents that caused it, but Mullen hadn't understood and was pretty sure Johnny didn't either. The mist approached the boat's prow, and suddenly they were in a strange twilight world, the motor muffled. Almost unconsciously, Johnny slowed down. Then they were through the thickest of it, and ahead Mullen could see the Ragged Island ledges, their cruel seaweed-covered flanks softened by the mist. They brought the skiff through a low spot in the ledges. As the sea-level mist cleared, Mullen could see the greenish tops of jagged underwater rocks covered with waving seaweed, the kind of rocks so feared by lobstermen at low tide or in heavy fog. But now the tide was high, and the little motorboat slid past effortlessly. After an argument about who was to get his feet wet, they grounded on the cobbled shore. Mullen jumped out with the painter and pulled the boat up, feeling the water squish in his sneakers. Johnny stepped out onto dry land. "Pretty neat," he said noncommittally, shouldering his satchel and looking inland. Just up from the stony beach, the sawgrass and chokecherry bushes began. The scene was lit by an eerie silver light, filtered through the ceiling of mist that still hung above their heads. A huge iron boiler, at least 10 feet high, rose above the nearby grass, covered with massive rivets and rusted a deep orange. There was a split down one side, ragged and petaled. Its upper half was cloaked by the low-lying mists.
"I bet that boiler blew up," Johnny said.
"Bet it killed somebody," Mullen added with relish.
"Bet it killed 2 people.
The cobbled beach ended at the seaward point of the island in ridges of wave-polished granite. Mullen knew that fishermen passing through the Ragged Island channel called these rocks the whalebacks. He scrambled up the closest of the whalebacks and stood high, trying to see over the bluffs into the island.
"Get down," Johnny yelled. "Just what do you think you're going to see in all this mist? Idiot!"
"Takes one to know one," Mullen began, climbing down, and received a brotherly rap on the head for his troubles.
"Stay behind me," Johnny said. "We'll circle the shore, then head back."
He walked quickly along the bottom of the bluffs, his tanned legs chocolate brown in the dim light. Mullen followed, feeling aggrieved. It was his idea to come out here, but Johnny always took over.
"Hey!" Johnny yelled. "Look!"
He bent down, picking up something long and white.
"It's a bone."
"No, it isn't," Mullen replied, still feeling annoyed. Coming to the island was his idea. He should have been the one to find it.
"It is too, and I bet it's from a man."
Johnny swung the thing back and forth like a baseball bat.
"It's the leg bone off somebody who got killed trying to get the treasure. Or a pirate, maybe. I'm going to take it home and keep it under my bed."
Curiosity overcame Mullen's annoyance.
"Let me see," he said.
Johnny handed him the bone. It felt surprisingly heavy and cold, and it smelled bad.
"Yuck,"
Mullen said, hastily handing it back.
"Maybe the skull's around here somewhere," Johnny replied.
They poked among the rocks, finding nothing but a dead dogfish with goggle eyes.
As they rounded the point, a wrecked barge came into view, left from some long-forgotten salvage operation. It was grounded at the high tide mark, twisted and pounded onto the rocks, buffeted by decades of storms.
"Look at this," said Johnny, interest rising in his voice.
He scrambled out on the heaved, buckled deck. All around it lay rusted pieces of metal, pipes, busted gears, and nasty snarls of cable and wire. Mullen began looking through the old junk, keeping an eye out for the gleam of a pirate doubloon. He figured that the pirate, Red Ned Occam, was so rich he'd probably dropped a whole lot of doubloons around the island. Red Ned, who'd supposedly buried millions and millions in gold on the island, along with a jeweled weapon called St. Michael's Sword, so powerful it could kill any man who even looked at it. They said Red Ned had once cut a man's ears off and used them to make a bet in a dice game. A sixth-grade girl named Cindy told him it was really the man's balls that Red Ned cut off, but Mullen didn't believe her. Another time, Red Ned got drunk and cut a man open, then threw him overboard and towed him by his guts until the sharks ate him. The kids at school had a lot of stories about Red Ned. Tiring of the barge, Johnny motioned for Mullen to follow him along the rocks that lay scattered at the bottom of the bluffs on the windward side of the island. Above them, a high dirt embankment rose against the sky, roots of long-dead spruce trees poking horizontally from the soil like gnarled fingers. The top of the embankment was lost in the clinging mists. Some of the bluffs were caved in and collapsing, victims of the storms that slammed into the island every fall. It was chilly in the shadow of the bluffs, and Mullen hurried on. Johnny, excited now by his finds, was bounding ahead, heedless of his own warnings, whooping and waving the bone. Mullen knew his mother would throw the old bone into the ocean as soon as she found it. Johnny stopped briefly to poke among stuff that had washed up on shore. Old lobster buoys, busted-up traps, pieces of weathered planking. Then he moved toward a fresh gash farther up the bluffs. A bank had recently caved in, spilling dirt and boulders across the rocky shore. He leaped easily over the boulders, then disappeared from view. Mullen moved more quickly now. He didn't like having Johnny out of sight. There was a stirring in the air. It had been a sunny day before they disappeared into the ragged island mist, but anything could be happening out there now. The breeze felt cold, as if weather was coming on, and the sea was beginning to break hard over the ragged island ledges. The tide would be close to turning. Maybe they'd better start back. There was a sudden, sharp cry, and for a terrible moment Mullen feared Johnny had hurt himself on the slippery rocks. But then the cry came again, an urgent summons, and Mullen scrambled forward, clambering over the fallen rocks and around a bend in the shoreline. Before him, a huge granite boulder lay at a crazy angle, freshly dislodged from the bank by a recent storm. On its far side stood Johnny, pointing, a look of wide-eyed wonderment on his face. At first, Mullen couldn't say a word. The movement of the boulder had exposed the opening of a tunnel at the foot of the bank, with just enough room to squeeze behind. A clammy stream of stale air eddied from the tunnel mouth.
"Cripes," he said, running up the slope toward the embankment.
"I found it," Johnny cried, breathless with excitement. "I bet you anything the treasure's in there. Take a look, Mullen."
Mullen turned.
"It was my idea."
Johnny looked back with a smirk.
"Maybe," he said, unshouldering his satchel. "But I found it, and I brought the matches."
Mullen leaned toward the tunnel mouth inquisitively. Deep down, he'd believed his father when he said there never was any treasure on Ragged Island. But now he wasn't so sure. Was it possible his dad could be wrong? Then he leaned back quickly, nose wrinkling against the stale smell of the tunnel.
"What's the matter?" Johnny asked. "Afraid?"
"No,"
said Mullen in a small voice. The mouth of the tunnel looked very dark.
"I'm going first," Johnny said. "You follow me, and you'd better not get lost."
Tossing his prize bone away, he dropped to his knees and squirmed through the opening. Malin knelt also, then hesitated. The ground was hard and cold beneath him, but Johnny was already disappearing from sight, and Malin didn't want to be left on the lonely, fog-bound shore. He squirmed through the opening after his brother. There was the snap of a match, and Malin sucked in his breath unconsciously as he rose to his feet. He was in a small antechamber, the roof and walls held up by ancient timbers. Ahead, a narrow tunnel led into blackness. "We'll split the treasure 50-50. Johnny was talking in a very serious voice, a voice Malin hadn't heard before. Then he did something even more surprising. He turned and shook Malin's hand with a childlike formality. "You and me, Mal. Equal partners." Malin swallowed, feeling a little better. The match died as they took another step forward. Johnny paused, and Malin heard the scratch of another match, followed by a flare of feeble light. He could see his brother's Red Sox cap haloed in the flickering flame. A sudden stream of dirt and pebbles rattled down through the timbers, bouncing across the stone floor. "Don't touch the walls," Johnny whispered, "and don't make any loud noise. You'll cave the whole thing in." Malin said nothing, but unconsciously moved closer to his brother. "Don't follow so close," Johnny hissed. They went forward along a downward incline. Then Johnny cried out and jerked his hand. The light went out, plunging them into darkness. "Johnny," Malin cried, feeling a surge of panic, reaching out to grasp his brother's arm. "What about the curse?"
"Come on. There's no curse,"
whispered Johnny scornfully. There was another scratching sound, and the match flared.
"Don't worry. I got at least 40 matches in here. And look."
He dug into his pocket, then turned toward Malin, a big paper clip held between his fingers. He stuck the lit match into one end.
"How about that? No more burned fingers."
The tunnel took a gentle turn to the left, and Malin noticed that the reassuring crescent of light from the tunnel entrance was gone.
"Maybe we should go back and get a flashlight," he said.
Suddenly, he heard a hideous sound, a hollow groan that seemed to erupt from the heart of the island and fill the narrow chamber.
"Johnny!"
he cried, clutching his brother again. The sound sputtered away into a deep sigh as another trickle of dirt fell from the timbers overhead. Johnny shrugged his arm away.
"Jeez, Malin, it's just the tide turning. It always makes that noise in the water pit." "Keep your voice down," I said.
"How do you know that?" Malin asked.
"Everybody knows that."
There was another moan and a gurgle, followed by a loud creaking of timbers that slowly died away. Malin bit his lip to keep it from trembling. A few matches later, the tunnel turned at a shallow angle and began sloping downward more steeply, its walls shorter and rougher. Johnny held his match toward the passage.
"This is it," he said. "The treasure chamber would be at the bottom."
"I don't know,"
Malin said.
"Maybe we better go back and get Dad."
"Are you kidding?" Johnny hissed. "Dad hates this place. We'll tell Dad after we get the treasure."
He lit another match, then ducked his head into the narrow tunnel. Malin could see that this passage wasn't more than 4 feet high. Cracked boulders supported the wormy timbers of the roof. The smell of mold was even stronger here, mingled with seaweed and a hint of something worse.
"We're gonna have to crawl,"
Johnny muttered, his voice momentarily uncertain. He paused, and for a hopeful instant Malin thought they were turning back. Then Johnny straightened one end of the paperclip and stuck it between his teeth. The wavering shadows thrown by the match gave his face a ghoulish, hollow look. That did it.
"I'm not going any farther,"
Malin announced.
"Good," said Johnny. "You can stay here in the dark."
"No,"
Malin sobbed loudly.
"Dad's gonna kill us. Johnny, please."
"When Dad finds out how rich we are, he'll be too happy to be mad.
He'll save a whole $2 a week on allowance."
Malin sniffed a little. and wiped his nose. Johnny turned in the narrow space and placed a hand on Malin's head.
"Hey," he whispered, his voice gentle. "If we chicken out now, we may never get a second chance. So be a pal. Okay, Mal?"
He ruffled Malin's hair.
"Okay,"
Malin sniffed. He got onto his hands and knees and followed Johnny down the sloping tunnel. Pebbles and grit from the tunnel floor dug into the palms of his hands. Johnny seemed to be lighting a whole lot of matches, and Malin had almost screwed up the courage to ask how many were left when his older brother halted abruptly.
"There's something up ahead," came the whispered voice.
Malin tried to see around his brother, but the tunnel was too narrow.
"What is it?"
"It's a door,"
Johnny hissed suddenly.
"I swear, it's an old door."
The ceiling angled up to form a narrow vestibule ahead of him, and Malin craned desperately for a view. There it was, a row of thick planks with two old metal hinges set into the frame of the tunnel. Large slabs of dressed stone formed the walls to either side. Damp and mold lay over everything. The edges of the floor had been caulked with what looked like oakum.
"Look!"
Johnny cried, pointing excitedly. Lying across the front of the door was a fancy embossed seal made of wax and paper, stamped with a coat of arms. Even through the dust, Johnny could see that the seal was unbroken.
"A sealed door,"
Johnny whispered, awestruck.
"Just like in the books."
Malin stared as if in a dream. A dream somehow wonderful and terrifying at the same time. They really had found the treasure, and it had been his idea. Johnny grasped the ancient iron handle and gave an exploratory tug. There was a sharp creak of protesting hinges.
"Hear that?"
he panted.
"It's not locked. All we have to do is break this seal."
He turned and handed the matchbox to Malin, his eyes wide.
"You light the matches while I pull it open. And move back a little, will you?"
Malin peered into the box.
"There's only 5 left,"
he cried in dismay.
"Just shut up and do it. We can get out in the dark, I swear we can."
Malin lit a match, but his hands shook and it flickered out.
"Only 4 more,"
he thought as Johnny muttered impatiently. The next match sprang to life, and Johnny placed both hands on the iron handle.
"Ready,"
he hissed, bracing his feet against the earthen wall. Malin opened his mouth to protest, but Johnny was already tugging at the door. The seal parted abruptly, and the door opened with a shriek that made Malin jump. A puff of foul air blew out the match. In the close darkness, Malin heard Johnny's sharp intake of breath. Then Johnny screamed, "Ouch!" Except the voice seemed so breathless, so very high, it almost didn't sound like Johnny. Malin heard a thump, and the floor of the tunnel shivered violently, as dirt and sand rained down in the darkness, filling his eyes and nose. He thought he heard another sound, a strange, strangled sound, so brief that it might almost have been a cough, then a wheezing, dripping noise like a wet sponge being squeezed.
"Johnny!"
Malin cried, raising his hands to wipe the dust out of his face and dropping the matchbox in the process. It was so very dark, and things had gone wrong so suddenly, and panic began to overwhelm him. In the close, listening darkness came another noise, low and muffled. It took Malin a moment to realize what it was. A soft, continuous dragging. Then the spell was broken, and he was fumbling in the dark on his hands and knees, hands outstretched, searching for the matches, bawling his brother's name. One hand touched something wet, and he snatched it away just as the other hand closed on the matchbox. Rising to his knees, choking back sobs, he grabbed a match and scratched it frantically until it flared. In the sudden light, he looked around wildly. Johnny was gone. The door was open, the seal broken, but beyond lay nothing except a blank stone wall.
Dust hung thickly in the air. Then wetness touched his legs, and he looked down. In the spot where Johnny had stood, there was a large, black pool of water, crawling slowly around his knees. For a crazy moment, Malin thought maybe there was a breach in the tunnel somewhere and seawater was leaking in. Then he realized the pool was steaming slightly in the flicker of the match. Straining forward, he saw that it was not black, but red. Blood. More blood than he ever imagined a body could hold. Paralyzed, he watched as the glossy pool spread, running in tendrils across the hollows of the floor, draining into the cracks, creeping into his wet kids, surrounding him like a crimson octopus, until the match dropped into it with a sharp hiss, and darkness descended once again. Chapter 2. Cambridge, Massachusetts, present day. The small laboratory looked out from the Mount Auburn Hospital Annex across the leafy tops of the maple trees to the slow, sullen waters of the Charles River. A rower in a needle-like shell was cutting through the dark water with powerful strokes, peeling back a glittering wake. Malin Hatch watched, momentarily entranced by the perfect synchronicity of body, boat, and water. "Dr. Hatch," came the voice of his lab assistant. "The colonies are ready." He pointed toward a beeping incubator. Hatch turned from the window, reverie broken, suppressing a surge of irritation at his well-meaning assistant. "Let's take out the first tier and have a look at the little buggers," he said. In his usual nervous way, Bruce opened the incubator and removed a large tray of auger plates, bacterial colonies growing like glossy pennies in their centers. These were relatively harmless bacteria. They didn't need special precautions beyond the usual sterile procedures, but Hatch watched with alarm as the assistant swung the rattling tray around, bumping it on the autoclave. "Careful there," said Hatch, "or there'll be no joy in Whoville tonight." The assistant brought the tray to an uneasy rest on the glove box. "Sorry," he said sheepishly, standing back and wiping his hands on his lab coat. Hatch gave the tray a practiced sweep with his eyes. Rows 2 and 3 showed good growth. Rows 1 and 4 were variable, and row 5 was sterile. In an instant, he realized the experiment would be a success. Everything was working out as hypothesized. In a month, he'd have published another impressive paper in the New England Journal of Medicine, and everyone would be talking yet again about what a rising star he was in the department. The prospect filled him with a huge feeling of emptiness. Absently, he swiveled a magnifying lens over to make a gross examination of the colonies. He'd done this so often that he could identify the strains just by looking at them, by comparing their surface textures and growth patterns. After a few moments, he turned toward his desk, pushed aside a computer keyboard, and began jotting notes into his lab notebook. The intercom chimed. "Bruce?" Hatch murmured as he scribbled. Bruce jumped up, sending his notebook clattering to the floor. A minute later, he returned. "Visitor," he said simply. Hatch straightened up his large frame. Visitors to the lab were rare. Like most doctors, he kept his lab location and telephone number under wraps to all but a select few.
"Would you mind seeing what he wants?"
Hatch asked.
"Unless it's urgent, refer him to my office. Dr. Winslow's on call today."
Bruce went off again, and the lab fell back into silence. Hatch's gaze drifted once again toward the window. The afternoon light was streaming in, sending a shower of gold through the test tubes and lab apparatus. With an effort, he forced his concentration back to his notes.
"He's not a patient," Bruce said, bustling back into the lab. "Says you'll want to see him."
Hatch looked up.
"Probably a researcher from the hospital," he thought. He took a deep breath.
"Okay. Show him in." A minute later, footsteps sounded in the outer lab. Malin looked up to see a spare figure gazing at him from the far side of the doorframe.
The setting sun was striking the man full force, modeling the sunburnt skin drawn tight across a handsome face, refracting light deep within a pair of gray eyes. "Gerard Needleman," the stranger said in a low, gravelly voice. Couldn't spend much time in a lab or the O.R. with a tan like that, Hatch thought to himself. Must be a specialist, getting in a lot of golf time. "Please come in, Dr. Needleman," he said. "Captain," the man replied. "Not doctor." He passed through the doorway and straightened up, and Hatch immediately knew it wasn't just an honorary title. Simply by the way he stepped through the door, head bent, hand on the upper frame, it was clear the man had spent time at sea. Hatch guessed he was not old, perhaps 45, but he had the narrow eyes and roughened skin of a sailor. There was something different about him, something almost otherworldly, an air of ascetic intensity that Hatch found intriguing. Hatch introduced himself as his visitor stepped forward and offered his hand. The hand was dry and light, the handshake short and to the point. "Could we speak in private?" the man asked quietly. Bruce spoke up again. "What should I do about these colonies, Dr. Hatch? They shouldn't be left out too long, and—" "Why don't you put them back in the refrigerator? They won't be growing legs for at least a few billion more years." Hatch glanced at his watch, then back into the man's steady gaze. He made a quick decision. "And then you might as well head home, Bruce. I'll put you down for 5. Just don't tell Professor Alvarez." Bruce flashed a brief smile. "Okay, Dr. Hatch. Thanks." In a moment, Bruce and the colonies were gone, and Hatch turned back to his curious visitor, who had strolled toward the window. "Is this where you do most of your work, Doctor?" he asked, shifting a leather portfolio from one hand to the other. He was so thin he would have seemed spectral were it not for the intensity of calm assurance he radiated. "It's where I do just about all of it." "Lovely view," Needleman murmured, gazing out the window. Hatch looked at the man's back, mildly surprised that he felt unoffended by the interruption. He thought of asking the man his business, but decided against it. Somehow he knew Needleman had not come on a trivial matter. "The water of the Charles is so dark," the captain said. "Far off from these a slow and silent stream, Lethe, the river of oblivion, rolls." He turned. "Rivers are a symbol of forgetfulness, are they not?"
"I can't remember," Hatch said lightly, but growing a little wary now, waiting.
The captain smiled and withdrew from the window. "You must be wondering why I've barged into your laboratory. May I ask a few minutes of your indulgence?"
"Haven't you already?"
Hatch indicated a vacant chair. "Have a seat. I'm about finished for the day here, and this important experiment I've been working on." He waved his hand vaguely in the direction of the incubator. "Is, how shall I put it, boring?" Needleman raised an eyebrow. "Not as exciting as fighting an eruption of breakbone fever in the swamps of Amazonia, I imagine."
"Not quite," Hatch said after a moment.
The man smiled. "I read the article in the Globe." Reporters never let the facts stand in the way of a story. It wasn't nearly as exciting as it seems. "Which is why you returned?"
"I got tired of watching my patients die for lack of a 50-cent shot of amoxicillin."
Hatch spread his hands fatalistically.
"So isn't it odd that I wish I were back there?
Life on Memorial Drive seems rather tepid by comparison." He shut up abruptly and glanced at Needleman, wondering what it was about the man that had gotten him talking. "The article went on to talk about your travels in Sierra Leone, Madagascar, and the Comoros," Needleman continued. "But perhaps your life could use some excitement right now."
"Pay no attention to my grousing," Hatch replied with what he hoped was a light tone. "A little boredom now and then can be tonic for the soul."
He glanced at Needleman's portfolio. There was some kind of insignia embossed into the leather that he couldn't quite make out. "Perhaps," came the reply. "In any case, it seems you've hit every spot on the globe over the last 25 years. Except Stormhaven, Maine." Hatch froze. He felt a numbness begin in his fingers and move up his arms. Suddenly it all made sense. The roundabout questions, the seafaring background, the intense look in the man's eyes. Needleman stood very still, his eyes steady on Hatch, saying nothing. "Ah," Hatch said, fighting to recover his composure. "And you, Captain, have just the thing to cure my ennui." Needleman inclined his head. "Let me guess. Does this, by any freak of chance, have to do with Ragged Island?" A flicker in Needleman's face showed that he had guessed right. "And you, Captain, are a treasure hunter. Am I right?" The equanimity, the sense of quiet self-confidence, never left Needleman's face. "We prefer the term recovery specialist." "Everyone has a euphemism these days. Recovery specialist. Sort of like sanitary engineer. You want to dig on Ragged Island. And let me guess, now you're about to tell me that you, and only you, hold the secret to the water pit." Needleman stood quietly, saying nothing. "No doubt you also have a high-tech gizmo that will show you the location of the treasure. Or perhaps you've enlisted the help of Madame Sesostris, famous clairvoyant." Needleman remained standing. "I know you've been approached before," he said. "Then you'll know the common fate of those who've approached me. Dowsers, psychics, oil barons, engineers, everybody with a foolproof scheme." "Their schemes may have been flawed," Needleman replied, "but their dreams were not. I know about the tragedies that befell your family after your grandfather bought the island, but his heart was in the right place. There is a vast treasure down there. I know it."
"Of course you do. They all do. But if you think you're the reincarnation of Red Ned himself, it's only fair to warn you that I've heard from several others who already claim that distinction. Or perhaps you purchased one of those old-looking treasure maps that occasionally come up for sale in Portland." "Captain Needleman, faith won't make it true. There never was and there never will be any Ragged Island treasure. I feel sorry for you, I really do. Now, perhaps you should leave before I call the guard. I beg your pardon, I mean the security specialist, to escort you to the door." Ignoring this, Needleman shrugged, then leaned toward the desk. "I don't ask you to take it on faith." There was something so self-confident, so utterly detached about the captain's shrug, that a fresh flood of anger swept Hatch. "If you had any idea how many times I've heard this same story, you'd be ashamed for coming here. What makes you any different from the rest?" Reaching inside the leather portfolio, Needleman withdrew a single sheet of paper and wordlessly pushed it across the desk. Hatch looked at the document without touching it. It was a simplified financial report, notarized, indicating that a company named Thalassa Holdings Limited had raised a sum of money to form the Ragged Island Reclamation Corporation. The sum was $22 million. Hatch glanced from the paper back to Needleman, then began to laugh.
"You mean, you actually had the nerve to raise this money before even asking my permission? You must have some pretty pliant investors."
Once again, Needleman broke into what seemed to be his trademark smile. Reserved, self-confident, remote without arrogance. "Dr. Hatch, you've had every right to show treasure hunters the door for the last 20 years. I perfectly understand your reaction. They were underfunded and underprepared. But they weren't the only problem. The problem was also you. He leaned away again. Obviously, I don't know you well. But I sense that after more than a quarter century of uncertainty, maybe at last you're ready to learn what really happened to your brother. Needleman paused for a moment, his eyes still on Hatch. Then he began again, in a tone so low it was barely audible. I know that your interest is not the financial reward, and I understand how your grief has made you hate that island. That is why I come to you with everything prepared. The Lassa is the best in the world at this kind of work, and we have equipment at our disposal that your grandfather could only have dreamed of. We've chartered the ships. We have divers, archaeologists, engineers, an expedition doctor, all ready to go at a moment's notice. One word from you, and I promise you that within a month the water pit will have yielded up its secrets. We will know everything about it. He whispered the word everything with peculiar force. Why not just leave it be? Hatch murmured. Why not let it keep its secrets? That, Dr. Hatch, is not within my nature. Is it within yours? In the ensuing silence, the distant bells of Trinity Church tolled 5 o'clock. The silence stretched on into a minute, then 2, and then 5. At last, Needleman removed the paper from the desk and placed it back in his portfolio. Your silence is sufficiently eloquent, he said quietly, no trace of rancor in his voice. I've taken enough of your time. Tomorrow I'll inform our partners that you have declined our offer. Good day, Dr. Hatch. He rose to go, and then just before the door he stopped, half turning. There is one other thing. To answer your question, there is something that makes us different from all the rest. We've uncovered a small piece of information about the water pit that nobody else knows. Not even you. Hatch's chuckle died in his throat when he saw Needleman's face. We know who designed it, the captain said quietly. Involuntarily, Hatch felt his fingers stiffen and curl in toward his palms. What? He croaked. Yes. And there's something more. We have the journal he kept during its construction. In the sudden silence, Hatch fetched a deep breath, then another. He looked down at his desk and shook his head.
That's beautiful, he managed to say.
Just beautiful.
I guess I underestimated you. After all these years, I've heard something original.
You've made my day, Captain Needleman. But Needleman had gone, and Hatch realized he was talking to an empty room. It was several minutes before he could bring himself to rise from the desk. As he shoved the last of his papers into his briefcase, hands still trembling a little, he noticed that Needleman had left his card behind. A telephone number had been scribbled across the top, presumably the hotel he was staying in. Hatch brushed the card into the wastebasket, picked up his briefcase, left the lab, and briskly walked back to his townhouse through the dusky summer streets. At 2 o'clock that morning, he found himself back in the laboratory, pacing before the darkened window, Needleman's card grasped in one hand. It was 3. Before he finally picked up the phone. Chapter 3 Hatch parked in the dirt lot above the pier and stepped slowly from the rented car. He closed the door, then paused to look over the harbor, hand still grasping the handle. His eyes took in the long, narrow cove, bound by a granite shore, dotted with lobster boats and draggers, bathed in a cold silver light. Even 25 years later, Hatch recognized many of the names. The Lola B, the Maybell W. The little town of Stormhaven struggled up the hill, narrow clabbered houses following a zigzag of cobblestone lanes. Toward the top, the houses thinned out, replaced by stands of black spruce and small meadows enclosed by stone walls. At the very top of the hill stood the Congregational Church, its severe white steeple rising into the gray sky. On the far side of the cove, he glimpsed his own boyhood home, its four gables and widow's walk poking above the tree line, the long meadow sloping to the shore, and a small dock. He quickly turned away, feeling almost as if some stranger was standing in his shoes, and that he was seeing everything through that stranger's eyes. He headed for the pier, slipping on a pair of sunglasses as he did so. The sunglasses and his own inner turmoil made him feel a little foolish. Yet he felt more apprehension now than he'd felt even in a Rarawana village, piled with corpses infected with dengue fever, or during the outbreak of bubonic plague in the Sierra Madre Occidental. The pier was one of two commercial wharfs that projected into the harbor. One side of the wharf was lined with small wooden shacks. The Lobsterman's Co-op, a snack bar called Red Ned's Eats, a bait shack, and an equipment shed. At the end of the pier stood a rusting gas pump, loading winches, and stacks of drying lobster pots. Beyond the harbor mouth there was a low fog bank, where the sea merged imperceptibly with the sky. It was almost as if the world ended 100 yards offshore. The shingle-sided co-op was the first building on the pier. A merry plume of steam issuing from a tin pipe hinted at the lobsters that were boiling within. Hatch stopped at the chalkboard, scanning the prices for the various grades of lobster. Cheddars, hard-shelled, chickens, selects, and culls. He peered through the rippled glass of the window at the row of tanks, teeming with indignant lobsters only hours removed from the deep. In a separate tank was a single blue lobster, very rare, put up for show. Malin stepped away from the window as a lobster man in high boots and a slicker rumbled a barrel of rotten bait down the pier. He brought it to a rest under a quayside winch, strapped it on, and swung it out to a boat waiting below, in an action that Malin had watched countless times in his childhood. There were shouts and the sudden throb of a diesel, and the boat pulled away, heading out to sea, followed by a raucous crowd of seagulls. He watched the boat dissolve, spectrally, into the lifting fog. Soon the inner islands would be visible. Already, Burnt Head was emerging from the mists, a great brow of granite rock that leaned into the sea south of town. Surf snarled and worried about its base, carrying to Hatch the faint whisper of waves. On the crown of the bluff, a lighthouse of dressed stone stood among the gorse and low bush blueberries, its red and white stripes and copper cupola adding a cheerful note of color to the monochromatic fog. As Malin stood at the end of the pier, smelling the mixture of redfish bait, salt air, and diesel fumes, his defenses, carefully shored up for a quarter of a century, began to crumble. The years dropped away, and a powerful bittersweet feeling constricted his chest. Here he was, back in a place he had never expected to see again. So much had changed in him, and so little had changed here. It was all he could do to hold back tears. A car door slammed behind him, and he glanced back to see Gerard Needleman emerge from the International Scout and stride down the pier, erect, brimming with high spirits, a spring of steel in his step. Smoke wafted from a briar pipe clamped between his teeth, and his eyes glimmered with a carefully guarded but unmistakable excitement. "Good of you to meet me here," he said, removing the pipe and grasping Hatch's hand. "I hope this hasn't been too much trouble." He hesitated slightly before saying the last word, and Hatch wondered if the captain had guessed his own private reasons for wanting to see the town and the island before making any commitment. "No trouble," Hatch replied coolly, accepting the brisk handshake. "And where is our good boat?" Needleman said, squinting out at the harbor, sweeping it appraisingly with his eyes. "It's the Plain Jane. Over there." Needleman looked. "Ah, a stout lobster boat." Then he frowned. "I don't see a dinghy in tow. How will we land on Ragged Island?"
"The dinghy's at the dock,"
Hatch said. But we're not going to land. There's no natural harbor. Most of the island is ringed with high bluffs, so we wouldn't be able to see much from the rocks anyway. And the bulk of the island is too dangerous to walk on. You'll get a better sense of the place from the water. Besides, he thought, I for one am not ready to set foot on that island. Understood, said Needleman, placing the pipe back in his mouth. He gazed up at the sky. The fog will lift shortly. Wind quartering to the southwest, a light sea. The worst we can expect is some rain. Excellent. I'm looking forward to this first look, Dr. Hatch. Hatch glanced at him sharply.
You mean you've never seen it before?
I've restricted myself to maps and surveys. I'd have thought a man like you would make the pilgrimage long ago. In days past, we used to get crackpots sightseeing around the island, even some attempts to land. I'm sure that hasn't changed. Needleman turned his cool gaze back to Hatch. I didn't want to see it unless we'd have the chance to dig it. A quiet force lay beneath his words. At the end of the pier, a wobbly gangplank led down to a floating dock. Hatch untied the Plain Jane's dinghy and grabbed the starter. Staying in town? Needleman asked as he stepped nimbly into the dinghy, taking a seat in the bow. Hatch shook his head as he started the engine.
I've booked a room in a motel in Southport, a few miles down the coast.
Even the boat rental had been done by an intermediary. He wasn't ready yet to be recognized by anyone. Needleman nodded, staring over Hatch's shoulders toward land as they motored out to the boat. Beautiful place, he said, smoothly changing the subject.
Yes, Hatch replied. I suppose it is.
There may be a few more summer homes, and there's a bed and breakfast now. But otherwise the world has passed Stormhaven by. No doubt it's too far north, off the beaten track.
That's part of it, Hatch said.
But all the things that look so quaint and charming. The old wooden boats, the weather-beaten shacks, the crooked piers, are actually the result of poverty. I don't think Stormhaven ever really recovered from the Depression. They came alongside the Plain Jane. Needleman boarded the boat while Hatch tied the dinghy to the stern. He clambered aboard and was relieved to hear the diesel start up on the first crank with a nice, smooth rumble. Might be old, he thought as he eased out into the harbor, but it's well kept up. As they cleared the no-wake zone, Hatch throttled up and the Plain Jane surged forward, slicing through the gentle swell. Overhead, the sun was struggling through the cloud cover, glowing in the remaining mist like a cold lamp. Hatch gazed southeastward, beyond Old Hump Channel, but could see nothing. It's going to be chilly out there, he said, glancing at Needleman's short-sleeved shirt. Needleman turned and smiled. I'm used to it. You call yourself Captain, Hatch said. Were you in the Navy? Yes, came the measured response. Captain of a minesweeper cruising off the Mekong Delta. After the war, I bought a wooden dragger out of Nantucket and worked George's Bank for scallops and flounder. He squinted out to sea. It was working that dragger that got me interested in treasure hunting.
Really?
Hatch checked the compass and corrected course. He glanced at the engine hour meter. Ragged Island was 6 miles offshore. They'd be there in 20 minutes. Needleman nodded. One day the net brought up a huge bolus of encrusted coral. My mate struck it with a marlin spike and the thing fell apart like an oyster. There, nestled inside, was a small 17th-century Dutch silver casket. That started my first treasure hunt. I did a little digging through records and figured we must have dragged over the wreck site of the Cinque Ports, a bark commanded by the French privateer Charles Dampier.
So I sold the boat, started a company, raised $1 million in capital, and went from there.
How much did you recover?
Needleman smiled slightly. Just over 90,000 in coins, china, and antiquities. It was a lesson I never forgot. If I'd bothered to do my research, I'd have looked up the manifests of the Dutch ships that Dampier attacked. They were mostly carrying lumber, coal, and rum. He puffed his pipe meditatively. Not all pirates were as skillful as Red Ned Occam. You must have been as disappointed as the surgeon who hopes for a tumor and finds gallstones. Needleman glanced at him. I guess you could say that. Silence fell as they headed seaward. The last wisps of fog disappeared, and Hatch could clearly make out the inner islands, Hermit and Wreck, green humps thickly covered with spruce trees. Soon Ragged Island would become visible. He glanced at Needleman, looking intently in the direction of the hidden island. It was time. "We've been chit-chatting long enough," he said quietly. I want to hear about the man who designed the water pit. Needleman remained silent for a moment, and Hatch waited. I'm sorry, Dr. Hatch, Needleman said. I should have made myself clear on that point in your office. You haven't yet signed the agreement. Our entire 22 million venture stands on the information we've obtained. Hatch felt a sudden surge of anger.
I'm glad you have so much faith in me.
You can understand our position, Needleman began. Sure I can. You're afraid I might take what you've discovered, dig up the treasure myself, and cut you out. Not to put too fine a point on it, Needleman said. Yes. There was a brief silence.
I appreciate your directness, said Hatch.
So how's this for a reply? He swung the wheel, heeling the boat sharply to starboard. Needleman looked at him inquiringly as he gripped the gunwale for support. Coming about 180 degrees, Hatch pointed the Plain Jane back toward port and throttled up. Dr. Hatch, Needleman said. It's quite simple, said Hatch. Either you tell me all about this mysterious find of yours and convince me you're not just another nut, or our little field trip ends right now. Perhaps if you'd be willing to sign our non-disclosure agreement.
For Christ's sakes,
Hatch cried. He's a damn sea lawyer as well as a sea captain. If we're to be partners, an ever-receding possibility, we'll have to trust each other. I'll shake your hand and give you my word, and that will be sufficient, or else you lose all hope of ever digging on the island. Needleman never lost his composure, and now he smiled. A handshake. How quaint. Hatch held the boat steady as she roared ahead, eating through the remains of wake laid down just minutes before. The dark bluff of Burnt Head came gradually into focus again, followed by the rooftops of the town. Very well, then, Needleman said mildly. Turn the boat around, please. Here is my hand. They shook. Hatch eased the engine into neutral and let the Plain Jane coast for a long moment. At last, engaging the throttle again, he nosed her seaward, gradually accelerating once more toward the hidden rocks of Ragged Island. A period of time passed in which Needleman gazed eastward, puffing on his pipe, seemingly in deep contemplation. Hatch stole a glance at the captain, wondering if this was some kind of delaying tactic. "You've been to England, haven't you, Dr. Hatch?" Needleman said at last. Hatch nodded. "Lovely country," Needleman went on, as coolly as if he was reminiscing for pleasure. "Especially to my taste. The North. Ever been to Hounsbury? It's a charming little town. Very Cotswolds, but all in all rather unremarkable, I suppose, if it weren't for its exquisite cathedral. Or have you visited Whitstone Hall in the Pennines?
the Duke of Wessex's family seat.
That's the famous one?
Built like an abbey?
Hatch said.
Exactly. Both delightful examples of 17th century ecclesiastical architecture.
Delightful,
echoed Hatch with a trace of sarcasm.
So what?
They were both designed by Sir William Macallan, the man who also designed the water pit.
Designed?
Yes. Macallan was a very great architect, perhaps England's greatest next to Sir Christopher Wren, but a far more interesting man. Needleman was still gazing eastward. In addition to his buildings and his work on Old Battersea Bridge, he left behind a monumental text on ecclesiastical architecture. The world lost a true visionary when he disappeared at sea in 1696.
Lost at sea. The plot thickens.
Needleman pursed his lips, and Hatch wondered if he was finally nettled. Yes, it was a terrible tragedy. Except, he turned toward Hatch. Except, of course, he was not lost at sea. Last year we uncovered a copy of his treatise. In the margins were what seemed to be a pattern of spottings and discolorations. Our laboratory was able to confirm that the discolorations were actually notes, written in invisible ink, just now becoming visible through the corruption of time. Chemical analysis showed the ink to be an organic compound derived from vinegar and white onions. Further analysis dated this stain, as invisible inks were then known, to approximately 1700.
Invisible ink. You've been reading too many Hardy Boys stories.
Invisible inks were very common in the 17th and 18th centuries, Needleman said calmly. George Washington used one for his secret dispatches. The colonists referred to it as writing with white ink. Hatch tried to phrase another sarcastic response, but was unable to articulate a reply. Against his will, he found himself half-believing Needleman's story. It was almost too incredible to be a lie. Our laboratory was able to recover the rest of the writing using a chemical wash. It turned out to be a document of around 10,000 characters written in Macallan's own hand in the margins of his book. The document was in code, but a Thalassa specialist decrypted the first half relatively easily. When we read the plain text, we learned that Sir William Macallan was an even more intriguing architect than the world had previously believed.
Hatch swallowed. I'm sorry, but this whole story sounds absurd.
No, Dr. Hatch, it is not absurd. Macallan designed the water pit. The coded writing was a secret journal he kept on his last voyage. Needleman took a moment to draw on his pipe. You see, Macallan was Scottish and a clandestine Catholic. After William III's victory at the Battle of the Boyne, Macallan left for Spain in disgust. There the Spanish crown commissioned him to build a cathedral, the greatest in the New World. In 1696 he set sail from Cadiz, bound for Mexico, on a two-masted brig, escorted by a Spanish man of war. The ships vanished and Macallan was never heard from again. It was assumed they were lost at sea. However, this journal tells us what really happened. Their ships were attacked by Edward Ockham. The Spanish captain struck his colors and was tortured into revealing the nature of his commission. Then Ockham put everyone to the sword, sparing only Macallan. The architect was dragged to Ockham in chains. The pirate put a saber to his throat and said, here I quote from the journal, "Let God build his own damned church. I have ye a new commission." Hatch felt a strange stirring of excitement. The captain leaned against the gunwale. You see, Red Ned wanted Macallan to design a pit for storing his immense treasure. An impregnable pit,
to which only Occam would have the secret. They cruised the main coast, picked out Ragged Island. The pit was constructed, and the treasure was buried. But of course, shortly thereafter, Occam and his crew perished, and McCallan, no doubt, was murdered as soon as the pit was finished. With them died the secret to the water pit. Needleman paused, his eyes almost white in the brightness coming off the water. Of course, that's no longer true, because the secret did not die with McCallan.
Explain.
Midway through his journal, McCallan switched codes. We think he did so specifically to record the secret key to the